What is up, brave conquerors? Welcome to No Holds Barred, the Shakespeare podcast Shakespeare would have listened to. I'm Dan Bollier.
And I'm Kevin Condardo. We are back with this month's So You're Going to See Shakespeare, which this is the once-a-month episode where we give you something that you can listen to in transit to a Shakespearean production so that we can prepare you to be the best little audience member that you can be.
An audio version of the dramaturgical notes, if you will.
So, this month, we hope you enjoy as you head out to see Love's Labor's Lost.
Here we go.
First thing we need to cover before we get into this episode is a quick synopsis of the play, so you at least know the story. Dan, why don't you kick us off for Love's Labor's Lost?
All right, so we begin in Navarre, Spain, with the king, Ferdinand, king of Navarre, his three friends, Barone, Longueville, and Dumain, and these four guys all swear to basically dedicate themselves to study for 3 years, and they will abstain from females and all of the things that could be distracting. And their only entertainment will be these two guys, Don Armato and Costard.
The locals.
Yep.
The very same Don Armato, a Spanish soldier who's kind of a blowhard in the Dogberry vein, is in love with a local girl named Jacquinetta. And when he finds Costard, the local idiot, hooking up with her in a park, he uses his power as a Spanish soldier to have him arrested. To which Jacquinetta has no discernible reaction, and Costard doesn't really think he did anything wrong.
Right. So, right after the boys have sworn off women, wouldn't you know it, the Princess of France and her three lady friends, Rosaline, Maria, and Catherine, they all arrive, attended by Boyette, and the gentlemen quickly realize that they're going to have to break their vows, and wouldn't you know, all four guys happen to be in love with all four girls, but they feel that they can't tell each other about that, because otherwise there would be no plot.
Right, that vow that they swore to about 3 seconds ago.
Right.
Meanwhile, Don Armato has decided that he wants to get a letter to his love, Jacquinetta, and he thinks the best person to get it to her is the guy who he just caught hooking up with her, logically. So he gets Costard out of prison in exchange for making this delivery. Meanwhile, Barone has the same excellent idea about getting his emotions in writing, which we know always ends poorly. And he gives a letter to Costard to deliver as well. Wouldn't you know it, the letters get switched. Jacquinetta gets the letter for Barone's beloved Rosaline, and Rosaline gets the letter for Don Armato's beloved Jacquinetta.
Right. So at this point, there's one of the great Shakespearean comedy scenes where all the boys come out and they're waxing poetic about their great love and through the forms of different sort of poetry. And of course, they're reading it out loud and one comes in and then sees, oh, here comes the second one. So let me jump in this bush. And the second one's talking like, oh, here comes the third one. Let me jump in this bush. So basically all four end up hiding in bushes. Well, no, not four. Three hide in bushes. And then one comes out like, how dare you? And then this third one comes out like, wait, no, how dare you? So they realize, hey, wait a minute, we're all in love. Why don't we just call this whole thing off and try to win these girls over?
Right. So they take the next logical step and do what every group of guys who wants to get a group of girls do. They dress up like Russians and approach the girls and try to seduce them in this strange foreign habit. It does not go well. Mostly because... So they come up to this whole plan. They put on these Russian disguises, these Russian accents, and they go to seduce the girls. What could possibly go wrong?
Well, what could go wrong, Kev, is that Boyette finds out about this plan, tells the girls. So the girls all switch their identities and wear masks so that when the guys come in to woo them, they woo the wrong one. Each guy woos the wrong girl and basically looks like a stupid idiot.
Mm-hmm. So these stupid idiots then go away, get out of their Russian, these Muscovite costumes, and they come back and they're like, so, you girls seen any cool dudes lately? And they're like, no, but there were these Russian idiots that just came through and were a bunch of morons, and all the boys are like, gull.
So then the action shifts back to Don Armato, who has now decided, wouldn't it be fun if we put on a play for the lords and ladies who are all here. So he rounds up two blowhard academics, Costard, Moth, who is this teeny tiny servant, and they're like, let's put on a play about the nine worthies. And this could, you know, we're going to become made men a la Midsummer Night's Dream, mm-hmm. only they have, they just do an somehow do a worse job in a play within a play. And the couple spend the whole time just berating them and making fun of them.
Mm-hmm. And the grand finale of the play is broken up just when Marcad, who is a servant of the princess's father, the King of France, arrives on the scene to break the news that the King of France has died and the Princess of France is now the Queen of France. She now, you know, when she has that moment of realization that now she has to be a grown-up, so she and the girls decide that they know that they have to go back to Paris, and the boys are like, well, why don't we get married? We'll come with you. And they say, nope, we want to, you know, your vows aren't really worth much, as we've discovered, so right. we're going to go away for a year, 1 year, not three. If you guys can keep it together for a year, we'll come back and we'll get married, but till then, good luck.
And that's the play.
Love's Labor's Lost. Now that you know generally what you'll be watching, we're going to take a few minutes to talk about where Love's Labor's Lost falls in Shakespeare's personal timeline and what was happening in the world when it was written. Daniel.
Yeah, so we have Love's Labor's Lost placed somewhere around 1594 or 1595. In terms of what that means for Shakespeare's world, he was at the same time writing Richard II, Midsummer Night's Dream, and Romeo and Juliet. So it's pretty good spell for old Bill.
Mm-hmm.
And you see, I think you see a lot of similarities between the three, honestly.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what happened with Shakespeare himself in terms of the world, Kev.
One of the interesting things that I just discovered in preparing for this was one of the things that we can date this to is that the actual King of Navarre had converted to Catholicism in 1593. So okay. He was kind of a persona non grata in England at that time.
Oh, okay.
But then he was back in English favor by 1594. So nice. It has to be after that, because in the meanwhile, that was too loaded a title to drop on a character.
Sure, that makes sense.
That was the big global political thing that I found.
That's interesting. There's a couple of things I noticed that jumped out at me in terms of the Spanish. In 1595, Sir Walter Raleigh, who would have been huge for the Elizabethan audience, he set off in search of El Dorado, which, of course, is Spanish for the Golden One,
mm-hmm.
Which was apparently this mythical tribal chief living somewhere in what we would now call Colombia, who covered himself in gold and then submerged himself in a lake and became this amazing, epic Spanish-influenced character, which helps me understand Don Armado a little bit.
Interesting.
That there's that sort of thing going on. At the same time, on July 23rd of 1595, in the western part of England, the Spanish raided Penzance and Mousehole, which were both in Cornwall, and burned the cities to the ground. It was 400 verse 13. So they raided the city, burned it to the ground, and then held a mass and then left, which I think is interesting, again, in terms of Don Armado and the Spanish warrior. Mm-hmm. Was very topical at the time.
Mm-hmm. And then in literature at the time, in other writing that was happening, there was a series of sonnets by Sir Philip Sidney mm-hmm. earlier, just before this, around 1591, a sonnet sequence, a critical work entitled The Defense of Poetry, all this poetry where Sidney was being real fancy and real rhetorical and really making words spin to his will. So sure. There's a thought that a part of this being so early in Shakespeare's career is that he was still trying to prove himself. So he sure. read Sidney and he's like, oh, you think you're wicked smart, huh? Well, here's some rhetoric. Here's some words right here. So you see a little bit more of the chip on his shoulder with the wordplay sure. with Shakespeare, and especially the rhymes in this one. But
right.
this is an unproven Shakespeare proving himself in a lot of spots, which is interesting to keep an eye out for.
The upstart crow.
Absolutely. So there you go. That is a little bit of the history of Love's Labor's Lost. This is where we identify what we consider to be the most prominent theme in the play and particular places where you may see it come up. Dan has chosen his three nominees, and I'm going to pick my choice of those for us to dig in on. Dan.
Yes.
Who are our finalists for Miss Best Theme?
In Love's Labor's Lost, the three finalists are education, writing, and commitment.
Commitment, Abby. I want to take commitment just because of all the... I can make 4 minutes of John Adams references. But I'll take writing.
Writing.
Yes.
I like it. So what brings you to that?
So I think it ties in, you know, what I was just saying about Sidney and about Shakespeare proving himself. I think there's a lot of... It's kind of open-handed skill with the pen that Shakespeare's showing.
Sure.
That there's not as much nuance. It's like, look at all the ways I can rhyme. Look at all the ways that I can change, structure, sonnets, all the sonnets I can slip in. Look at all the... Right. I can make smart people sound dumb and dumb people sound smart, and I can just throw out some Latin here. So I think there's some in the meta writing of this. I think there's a lot to see.
Yeah.
And then...
in the very beginning, the dangers of putting things in writing.
Oh, interesting.
When you have, you know, these two letters that get mixed up, and the fact that things are being written down that people, you can't really say he said, or when the guys overhear each other, there's no sense of like, well, I didn't say that. It's like, no, it's in your hand. You wrote it down and you're reading the poem.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a different thing than, you know, for such an oral tradition and an oral culture in Shakespeare's time. Here you have a nice warning against the power of putting something on a piece of paper and what that means.
Also, the fact that everyone, both high and low in this play, is writing stuff constantly. The boys are all writing. The mechanicals, for lack of a better word, they're all writing letters to each other. Everyone's sending letters around.
Which says a lot about the people in the play.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, even the lowest status have the ability to write, which is different for that period than nowadays in 2016.
Mm-hmm. And the type of writing that they're doing is not, they talk at the beginning, they have this whole vow about study, and we don't see them study for 1 second. All they do is write love poems. They're not working on physics, and they're not, like, you know, seeking the theory of relativity or whatever. They're just seeing who can write the best poem.
Sure.
Doing their own writing gymnastics.
And then we also have the characters who we talked about briefly in the synopsis of Nathaniel and Holofernes, who are obsessed with language and words, and to the point that they make no sense, you know, complete nonsense. And it's Moth that calls them out on it.
Mm-hmm.
You've been to a feast of words and taken away the scraps, or a feast of language and taken away the scraps. You know, it's just like, what a great dig.
It is a great, Moth has some excellent digs in here. And then finally, you know, the play, The Nine Worthies, where they bring out all of the great characters of writing from throughout history. They have Hercules and Spring and Winter and, I mean, Judas.
Famous writer, Spring.
Oh my God, stop. Judas Maccabees. It's the goddess of Spring. I don't know. I'm not brushed up on my Greek gods right at the moment. Judas Maccabeus, not Judas Iscariot, in a bit that really kills with the biblical crowd.
Right. Well, the recently Catholic King of Navarre.
Right.
You know, that's a nice jab for you, sir.
And there you go.
From your boy Bill.
From Billy. So I think there's, you know, Much Ado About Noting has a lot of noting in it as well, but there are more notes in this than there are in that, I think.
Have you talked at all yet about the fact that Much Ado About Noting may be Love's Labor is One?
We have
the lost sequel.
That
it's, is this a good time for that?
I don't
sneak
see
it in
a better place to put it, so go for it.
Great. But there's a sense, you know, that if you look at this is so structured in verse and the rhyming couplets all the way throughout. And then you have Much Ado About Noting, which is basically 70% prose as a response piece to this play. Is some theorist, conspiracy theorist, will tell you, no, we didn't lose Love's Labor's One. We just call it Much Ado About Nothing.
Mm-hmm. So that's basic. That's about writing, very loosely. So that, it's a different play that he wrote. So well, there
that's
you
about
go.
Hearing.
Oh my god. In anyways, best theme. Thanks. In this section of the show, we choose which non-title characters we most want to play in this piece and explain why in 2 minutes or less. Dan won the coin flip before the show.
Yes!
And has elected to make his joke about not playing Love's Labor's Lost first.
Yes, I will. And now, since I can't play the labor that has been lost, not Love's Labor's Lost, I can't play the labor.
Mm-hmm.
What I would like to play in this play, is I think a role that suits me very well, is Costard.
Okay.
We have a once again, a very intelligent, maybe the smartest guy in the play. That sounds like me.
Costard?
Yeah, of course. Really smart fool.
Challenge?
No, I think he's pretty smart.
Okay.
See, this is where, in performance, I would go more of the puckish route.
Okay.
Did he mix those letters up, or is he like,
Oh.
Let's see what pots I can stir here.
Okay.
Also, just, you know, that I love just low level broad comedy.
Mm-hmm.
Like he's a clown, and he's one of those characters that has a blast,
mm-hmm.
and is just messing with people for 2.5 hours, or 2 hours, depending on the cut, I suppose. But I would just love to get in there and just all the stuff with Jack Winnetta. You get the great scenes with Don Armato.
Mm-hmm.
He's always in some of the most fun scenes.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like I would kill it as Costard.
If I could be honest.
Who, me?
So for me in this one, I actually am most fascinated. I don't know that I would be cast in this role, but I think the most I know I wouldn't be cast in this role, but I think one of the more interesting roles to play in this would be the Princess of France, actually.
Okay.
And what I like about the Princess of France in this piece is that, you know, this is a play, again, we were talking about all the punning, all the wordplay. There's a lot as part of that wordplay, especially among the younger characters, there's a lot of sexual overtones, a lot of, you know, blue material that they're playing around with.
Yeah.
And the princess takes the high road and is one of the only ones who doesn't get her hands dirty with those types of off-color jokes. Mm. And I think it's an interesting look at her propriety, her carriage as a princess.
Okay.
That none of the other, definitely not the boys and the girls kind of, the rest of the girls kind of fade away from. But the fact that she is still having fun, I like her journey in this, in that she's trying to be an adult and is having better success at being an adult than anyone else who's trying to be an adult.
You're right.
And I think it's kind of tragic that I feel like she only starts to have fun in that last scene right before someone comes in and says, your dad's dead.
Right.
And it's like, I think there is something to be played there that I would like to mine.
Have you seen that played that way before?
Maybe not so specifically that way.
Yeah.
I've seen it.
I never have. That sounds great.
Yeah. So I think there is something to be played there that, you know, it's like, well, that's what I get for having a good time, I guess.
Yeah.
You know?
It's how very Boston of you.
Right? It's my fault. Because I relaxed for a second. So there you go. So I would like to do, so that would be my choice, the Princess of France.
Nice. I'll cast you in that.
Thanks. This is the section of the show where we pull our favorite phrase from this play and talk through it so that you can nod smugly and knowingly when you hear it. The line we chose from Love's Labor's Lost is, "Even so, my tale is told." From Act 5, Scene 2. Let's hear the phrase in context.
God save you, madam.
Welcome, Mercad. But that thou interrupt'st our merriment.
I am sorry, madam, for the news I bring is heavy in my tongue. The king, your father...
Dead. For my life.
E'en so, my tale is told.
Boyette, prepare, I will away tonight. Prepare, I say. I thank you, gracious lords, for all your fair endeavors, and entreat out a new sad soul that you vouchsafe in your rich wisdom to excuse or hide the liberal opposition of our spirits. If over boldly we have borne ourselves in the converse of breath, Your gentleness was guilty of it. Farewell, worthy lord. A heavy heart bears not a nimble tongue. All right. That was Even So, My Tale Is Told from Act 5, Scene 2. Should we do a little...
Even So, My Tale Is Told.
Oh, did I do that wrong?
I took the line. I nailed it.
You're a gem.
It was a monosyllabic 10-beat line, of course. Dead for my life, Even So, My Tale Is Told.
Oh, behind the curtain. All right.
That's right.
Doing your paperwork. So, for a little context on this... this is right at the end of the play. This is what we were just talking about, actually, in the recommended roles section. That this is the play by the Mechanicals, or not, you know, the pseudo Mechanicals,
right?
The faux Mechanicals.
Mechanicals 2.0,
right? The reboot. They they're putting on this play. A whole scuffle breaks out, and then Mercad shows up with this news that the princess's father is dead, and this is her response. And the whole party basically stops as she prepares to leave.
Right. The play comes to a grinding halt.
Grinds to a halt. Yeah.
So we should probably explain why we think this is one of the favorite phrases from the play.
Yeah. So I think, you know, it is so fascinating, I think, about this line is that this is this whole character.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's very, this is probably your, you know, if we're going to get into advanced Shakespeare metrics.
Yes.
This guy has the biggest impact per line in the canon.
It's a bold statement, but you're probably right.
He has four lines and he turns the play he changes every character on stage.
Okay.
And then is like, I'm good.
Yeah. It's a pretty strong argument.
With my general manager hat is a nightmare because that means you can't just have someone else put on a hat and be this guy.
Right.
Like, this needs to be an outsider. But right. Then, does that mean you're paying somebody a full favored nation's rate to, you know, sit in the background and read a newspaper, do four lines, and then go home?
Yeah, so. I mean, I think putting an artistic director hat on, you absolutely are. You want someone that has that sort of power.
Yeah, well...
And that the audience has never seen. They're not like, oh, yeah, that's the guy who played...
Right.
Who knows?
Jaquanetta, yeah.
Right.
So I think that's, with that in mind, with the gravity of this line, even so, my tale is told. I mean, especially when you look at it in the context
Even
of...
So.
Even so, my tale is told. When you look at it in the context of other messengers that come in other plays, they like to talk all about how, you know...
Yeah.
For he was sick, and then they tried... All the doctors found no relief. Nope.
Right.
Mercad doesn't need that.
Right.
Even so...
And that's all the more meaningful, especially as we've been talking about how meaningful words are in this play. That it's not just messengers in other plays, but here, these characters love language.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the princess that cuts him off. The king, your father, dead for my life. And so, that's it.
Nothing.
She doesn't want the full story.
Yeah. And there's nothing. And what else are you going to say? Nuff said.
Right.
You know?
Right.
That's it.
I got to go now.
He's dead. Cool.
Exit.
We're done here.
It's a very powerful, powerful moment. I remember we were working on this last year, and mm-hmm. you were describing this character as like coming from a different planet or a mm-hmm. different world from everyone that we've seen. I thought that was really a really interesting take on Mercad.
Yeah, I mean, not literally a different planet, like this is the Little Prince production or something, but like, you know, that he's... They're basically, I picture, I mean, the way I see this play is all these kids are 18, they're on spring break, they're getting drunk, they're sleeping in a field because they can, you know, learning about themselves, having this party, this lawn party.
Right.
And then, you know, like a Secret Service member from the girl's dad who's a senator comes in as serious as can be, as serious as a judge, and is like... Yeah.
Time to grow up.
Real life happened.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. It's a pretty powerful moment.
Yeah. And, you know, it's really fascinating to see a play turn on a dime like that. And that's a moment where, you know, you realize, yeah, this is all fun and games, but you have a little existential crisis. Like, oh, we're all having fun, but ultimately we're all going to die. So
that's
the moment that, you know, maybe you're grabbing onto your significant other's hand in the theater because it's like, it's so fleeting, isn't it?
Right?
Life is so fragile.
We only have the right now.
Do you want to go
get hammered on at a lawn party, because that looked like it was pretty fun. If we're all going to die anyways,
if you a Russian show, if you want.
If you want to miss the point, hang on, I have to go put on my babushka. So
well, this is also a great moment of like, this was when finally the play's title makes sense. If you're watching the play, you're like, why is this called Love's Labor's Lost?
Right? It is kind of a weird spoiler, Love's Labor's Lost.
Right?
I never really thought about that.
This is when it becomes that play.
Yeah. Interesting.
You know.
Yeah, so there you go. Keep an ear out for it. Even so.
Yeah.
My tale is told. Here, we will highlight the biggest practical challenge to the director in this play and share a few ideas on how it has been solved in the past. For Love's Labor's Lost, I think the biggest challenge is the stage direction, quote, enter Moth, Ferdinand, Barone, Longueville, and Dumaine in Russian habits and masked from Act 5, Scene 2.
Yes.
Do you want to give us? Do you want to just touch up on the context on this? I guess
sure.
We already covered it, but
we just kind of did. But it's worth noting. So yes, and if you note carefully, this is still Act 5, Scene 2. Mm-hmm. Earlier in the scene,
the longest scene in Shakespeare,
and I believe it.
Feels it.
Which I think is part of why this is the greatest challenge. Is that, you know, when you're thinking about the structure of a scene, but I get ahead of myself. Mm-hmm. A little context. This is the boys coming in dressed as these Russians in their attempt to seduce the women under the guise of being Muscovites. And there are a bevy of challenges that come along with mm-hmm. that for the director in terms of how do you want to approach this seemingly bizarre stage direction.
Mm-hmm. Both, you know, practically costume wise, but also like so that you don't lose the audience when they're like, wait, what?
Right.
They're going to do what?
Right.
And then you get into, are they going to do Russian accents? How right. thick are their Russian accents?
Are they good at this, guys?
Right. How many layers are you going to make these people put on, and how many lights are going to be on them?
Right.
How long are they out there?
You also have to find the clever moments of business so that you can still have the audience know who is who. Mm-hmm. And who they're supposed to be wooing and who mm-hmm. they're actually wooing.
Right, because the girls are masked as well. So you can't
right.
see any of the eight people. So do you make their costumes really good or really bad? And
right.
what are the highs and lows of all those choices?
And are they into this? Are some of the guys really good at it? If the girls didn't know from Boyette, would they have figured it out? Or are these guys just like, oh, no.
Is this doomed? Is this
ill-fated.
Failure to launch, yeah. Yeah, so it's an interesting challenge, and there's no way to skirt around it. You gotta just
right.
slam into it at 60 miles an hour.
Right.
Dan, how have you seen this done before?
I have seen this play three times, four times. This is always one of the more memorable scenes, mm-hmm. But it's frequently done. I think with a play like this, it's usually done, at least the way I've seen it, as slapstick.
Mm-hmm.
That it's the guys are terrible. Mm-hmm. The girls are way smarter. They find it endearing. For the most part, the girls do find it endearing, which is nice.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just comedy.
Mm-hmm.
Just
broad.
Super broad.
Yeah.
It's, you know, it's
the yeah.
mustaches falling off.
Right.
Like, the guys just are helpless.
Right. They're doing that dance, the stereotypical Russian dance. Like, I've seen that one where they come in yeah. and they do a dance when they arrive, and it's the thing where you, like, sit down and you kick your feet out.
Right.
You know, that, like...
From Fiddler on the Roof?
Exactly. That, like, Soda Popinski type of thing.
Yeah.
And
seen a lot of big beards. A
lot of big beards. A lot of big hats. A lot
yep.
of big furry hats.
Yep.
A lot of Cold War era jackets. A
yep.
lot of sweating actors.
That's right.
A lot of sweaty actors in this scene. I have never seen this even close to being done with them being good at this.
No.
I don't know. I wonder if it would work.
I think it would.
Like, if they were actually convincing.
Right.
I think, you know what I think the best goof would be? If one of them was good. Like, if, I don't know, I need to go through, like, the order, but, like, if suddenly Barone was, like, really convincing.
I think if you made it, like, Longueville or Dumaine, it'd be funnier, because then Barone could be like, what?
Oh, come on.
This is my show.
Yeah. The other thing that we missed out, that I forgot to, that we didn't mention earlier, is that the other challenge to the director is, I don't think they're called Russians anywhere in this play. They're always referred to as Muscovites.
Right.
Which is a region in, you know, what we would recognize as that, you know, USSR Russian area. So if you're listening to everyone in the scenes leading up to this being like, oh, they're dressed up as Muscovites, and you're like, is that a seafood dish? What is that?
It's in the mole family, I believe.
Right? So you need to get across that, like, this is what a Muscovite is. It's right. A stereotypical Russian thing.
The only challenge here for the director is, and this gets back to how this is the longest scene in the canon, is you basically have two plays within a play in the same scene.
That's true, yeah.
So you can't blow all of your comedy here. Mm-hmm. You got to save something for the nine worthies. And it also has to be distinctly different in tone, I think, or else the audience is like, come on, I've already seen this.
Right.
So that's part of the challenge is you get, this is your first one, and then you got to do it all again. Which goofs do you use where?
Yeah, goof rationing is an important thing in this scene.
It's a native of the Muscovite, a goof ration.
Oh, nice. I got fresh Muscovites in my goof ration. Hashtag that whole thing. And that is going to do it for So You're Going to See Love's Labor's Lost. If you found this helpful, please subscribe, rate, and review us in iTunes so we can keep bringing Shakespeare to your headphones on a weekly basis. If you have questions or comments you'd like to send our way, you can email us at noholdsbarredpodcast@gmail.com. You can tweet us at noholdsbarredcast, or you can Facebook us at facebook.com/noholdsbarredcast. Until next time, I'm Kevin Condardo.
And I'm Dan Bollier.
The words of Mercury are harsh after the songs of Apollo.
You that way. We this way. Adieu, adieu, adieu.